Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 26. So, you're weaving. Have you ever dreamed about creating beautiful art-to-wear garments, but find that the idea of cutting into your hand-woven cloth makes you feel faint? Do you fear that you'll never get an accurate fit? Well, not to worry. This episode, talented weaver and sewer Dara Lancaster shares her insights into navigating the journey from cones of yarn to finished garment. I describe my own forays into the uncharted territory of sewing in the final essay, Uniquely Me. They say it's spring. We had an equinox and everything. Will somebody please tell me why there is 6 inches of fresh new snow outside my door? I'm sitting in my studio. It's a beautiful sunny day outside, and it looks like the dead of winter. But actually, I'm rather enjoying this late season snow. There's something so peaceful about the way the flakes drift down. And with a fire in the wood stove and some fiber arts to entertain me, I am quite content to wait a little bit longer for the return of the green. Our sponsor this episode is Spady Studios. Robin Spady, a talented weaver and instructor, offers workshops, programs, and private weaving instruction. Please check out her website at www.spadystudios.com. And as always, there will be a link to it on the show notes. I'm here with Dara Lancaster, the woman who got me over my fear of cutting up handwoven fabric to make garments, which was huge. I'm delighted to have you in the studio, and welcome.
Thank you, Sine. I can't tell you how much fun it is to be here in Seattle.
Which came first for you, sewing or weaving?
I was a sewer first. My mother, who taught tailoring, was a phenomenal dressmaker. She took me when I was 10 years old to JCPenney's fabric store. It is probably the top memory from my childhood. I walked in these fabrics. I could pick a pattern. I could change the way the pattern looked. I could pick a different fabric. It was a world that opened up. And I will tell you, in over 40 years of sewing, I don't think there's ever been a day when the sewing machine has not spoken to me in an enthusiastic and creative way. It's just been my friend for 40 years. It doesn't matter what's going on in my life, I can sit at that machine and it will take my hand.
What is it about sewing that keeps you coming back?
Clothing is really what I sew. I don't do quilts. I don't do home decor. I am a clothing person. We get dressed every morning. I love to put together a different outfit based on what's in my closet, depending on who I want to be that day. There is such a creativity in voice in dressing yourself. And as a creative fiber person, what I put on my body coming from my own hands, it's like a spiritual connection. I was a production hand weaver for about 10 years where I wove production yardage and then cut it and sewed it into garments and went and did craft fairs. And I sold to a few galleries. But I will tell you, I was not as personally connected to the clothing the way I am now. Because there, I was making a product, and it went to somebody else. And it was largely who could afford it. I could fit anybody. So there were a lot of women who had bodies that were maybe not the standard and were thrilled to get a piece of hand woven that would work with their body. But I wasn't as fulfilled as a craftsman making clothing for other people. I found that teaching other people to make clothing for their own bodies, to introduce themselves to who they really are physically, the way their body parts are put together, how to make the clothing work on their body. And then the ultimate is to be able to put on something that they made I've had women stand in front of the mirror when they were finished and cry. It's such an incredible experience to be able to put that whole package together. You know, the cloth from the loom, the sewing machine, the skills that they need to do that, and to stand there and look at themselves in a new way with something that really fits them.
Something I noticed when I took your fit workshop is that the beginning of the class was almost like group therapy.
Uh-huh.
Because I've been sewing or trying to sew for years, and I've always struggled with fit. I wear a size 12, so I'd go and buy a size 12 pattern. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Just have to understand a little bit about what the pattern industry has gone through. When women began to dump their rigid corseted underpinnings in the late 50s, the pattern industry and the ready-to-wear industry realized that they had to resize women's garments because the size standards that we had were based on an unnatural female form. The Bureau of the U.S. government that was responsible for coming up with a new fit model was the Bureau of Weights and Standards, run by men, and needed a group of women that would represent the country they could do these measurements from, which, of course, at that time, the only women employed by the U.S. government were women in the Army Corps who were under 30, never been pregnant or married and been to boot camp, or airline stewardesses who had to be a 5'7", certain body weight. So this is where the fit standard began. The ready-to-wear industry has basically paid attention to their client. If you're making clothing and it's not fitting the people that are buying it, you change your fit standard. So the ready-to-wear industry has long since deviated from that. And if you'll notice, they're playing into the psyche of women who all want to be smaller than they are. This is why we now have size zero in the store. Because if you are a designer and you have a garment that's a size six, and the next rack over is a different designer with a garment that's a size 4, and they're identical garments, which one are you going to buy? Well, the pattern industry, God bless them, has stayed with this standard and not deviated since 1960. Well, I started sewing in 1965. So I remember one of the first things my mother taught me was that I had to look at the pattern and look for the little pink label that said new sizing, which made me understand that there was an old sizing and that there was a crossover there, and you had to make sure you were working with the right size chart. So I know that there was a transition in 1965. So we're still working on that same new sizing from 1965. And with the huge cultural diversity in this country now and the mixing in and of different cultural body types, the aging of the population, women crossing into menopause, totally different body situations and images, you have a mixture of normal, which has no relationship to what the pattern industry has said. One of the greatest things that ever happened to me, and this may sound like an odd thing to say, I went through breast cancer 5 years ago. And for someone who teaches about body image and goes around the country working with women, especially in the hand weaving community, where you have a large population of women who are in the menopausal years, it was real interesting for me to clinically stand back and look at the changes in my body, not only losing a breast to breast cancer, but going through chemotherapy, which at 46 years old threw me into instant menopause. I could stand in front of the mirror and watch what would normally take 10 years as the hormones diminish, your body gradually changes. So it's subtle. You don't catch it right away. Well, in 3 months, I had lost 3/4 of an inch in height. My entire lower body began to expand, and I began to get shapes where there weren't shapes before. It taught me so much what actually happens, because I could see it happening to my own body in a short period of time. That made it so much easier for me as a teacher to talk about and relate to what my students were experiencing. I can't tell you how many times I get a student in a class who will say to me, you know, with tears in their eyes, I had a 21-inch waist once. Well, first of all, let me tell you what a 21-inch waist looks like. Go to your kitchen and get a new roll of paper towels and wrap the tape measure around it. A roll of paper towels is 21 inches around, give or take. That's unrealistic in this day and age. And if you're menopausal, it's totally unrealistic. We've earned every bit of whatever's on our body. We have been through, we've raised children, we've gone through all kinds of changes. Those are all things that happen to the physical body. But there is no reason and no excuse why you can't be reintroduced to the body you have now in whatever condition it's in and learn to make something from your hands that celebrate who you are now.
The most important lesson I took away from your workshop was fit can be psychological. Because instead of trying to take your body and make it fit the clothing, you learn to take the clothing and fit your body. And that was so powerful.
It is a lot easier to alter that piece of paper than it is to change your body. And the biggest thing I encourage students to do is go clean out their linen closet. All those things you got as wedding presents, 3 marriages ago, whatever. Take sheets, towels, and just begin to put them together. Buy some patterns. Play with them. Try them on. You don't have to actually make something. We're such a goal-oriented society. If you take a sheet and you cut it up and you make something without the goal of actually wanting to wear it, you learn so much. This is about learning your body and learning how to fit it. Now, I will tell you that it is very, very difficult to fit yourself. You can't get around yourself. You can't see what's going on in the back. I cannot tell you how important it is to have a dress form. I had one when I was 15 years old. And my mom had one, and we had all of our little dress forms for the whole family lined up in the dining room. And it made it so much easier to work on the piece and to get around yourself. There are all kinds of ways to do a dress form, and you'll find videos of how to make one out of duct tape that's exactly you. And there are also ones that you can purchase where you sort of dial up a size. The problem with those is it doesn't put the body parts exactly where you are. I personally have always used, and it's still available, one called Uniquely You. The Uniquely You dress form is roughly a female-shaped foam dummy. And it has a muslin cover with about 100 seams. And this 4-page step-by-step, which seam you open and you put it on your body. And now you have to have a helper to do this. You can't do this on yourself. But when you're done, this is a molded skin of you. You unzip the muslin off of you and you stuff that foam body into it. And it requires usually knees and tugging and, you know, two people to get the foam in there. But you end up with a reasonable facsimile of your body, which you can then pin into to support and hold and drape. I was trained in flat pattern work. I've since discovered the joy of draping and working the fabric to the body. When you skip the flat pattern middleman, there's a relationship of just working a fabric and seeing what it can do that I've really not had a lot of experience in, and I'm loving every minute of it.
Do you find it makes you more creative?
Oh, yeah, totally. I just did a dress. I found 2 yards of an old production fabric, and I pulled it out, and I just started playing on the dress form, and I did this amazing dress with one seam that just wraps bias up around like this sort of Grecian goddess, totally form-fitting with this thing that goes over the shoulder. I didn't mention muslins and how important that is that you always make it up first in something junky. Don't be deceived by the lure of, well, I'll make it in something that if I like the way it fits, I can still wear it, because you're going to settle. If you make it up in something junky, an old bed sheet, and I've had people say to me, well, the bed sheet doesn't relate to hand-woven fabric. It'll tell you the information you need on fit. It begins there. I've actually made hand-woven garments and muslins out of bath towels. Why not? It's got the thickness and the loft. You would be amazed what you can learn making the garment first in a bed sheet. And some of the tests that I do when I'm fitting a garment don't require even my eyes. I put the garment on and I close my eyes and I feel where the pockets are, feel where the collar is, put it around yourself, feel with your eyes closed. It's not something that you're taught to do, and yet it's an instinct. You put the garment on and you immediately cross the C7 vertebrae, which is that bone that protrudes out the back of the neck. That's the balance point for garments in the back. And the back neck seam should bisect that, unless you have something like
that. When you
like
say the balance point, that's where the garment hangs
from. That's where the garment hangs from.
Yeah.
Correct. You will automatically put a garment on and bisect that bone with the back neck seam, whether it was supposed to be cut there or not. And one of the mistakes that a lot of hand weavers make who make loom-shaped clothing is they just think the back neck is a smaller circle than the front neck. Well, in fact, the back neck isn't a circle at all because the head sits on the spine, not like a candy apple, but it sits forward of the spine. So if you looked at a French curve, which is the French couture ruler that sets the back neck shape, it's very shallow. If you cut too big of a scoop in the back neck, what you do is then you put the garment on and the scoop will come to that C7 vertebrae and the whole back of the garment hikes up. This was such a problem 6, 7, 8 years ago. There was sort of a term tossed around at fashion shows, weaver's hike, because everybody assumed it was because it was a hand-woven garment. No, it's because it's a bad pattern. Those are the kinds of things that you can check. And as you age and your spine and your whole body structure changes and your bones thin, the whole curvature of the spine comes forward, actually lengthening that back in there. And you may have a perfectly engineered pattern, but on your body, you need more length in the back neck to accommodate an aging spine. So it's not unusual to have somebody in their 70s or 80s where I have to add length to the back neck in order to keep the garment grain lines parallel and perpendicular to the floor. That's the other key that I teach my students is when you assess a muslin, you're looking that the vertical grain lines are all perpendicular to the floor, which presumably would be the warp, the weft threads, which should be at right angles to the warp threads, should be parallel to the floor at all times. If they're not, it's a problem with the pattern. And put them where they need to be, and then trace back and see what's missing. When you begin to learn how to see that, that's why making a muslin out of some cheap, garbagey plaid, if it's got a warp and weft plaid, those are the things you can pick up instantly. I don't actually make muslins out of muslin. It doesn't tell me anything because it's too hard to see the grain lines.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Plus the fact that muslin's really expensive. You hit the junk tables at a cheapy fabric place. Bed sheets that had plaids on them. I mean,
yeah, go to Goodwill.
Go to Goodwill. Whatever you can find that's big enough yardage to cut up and make what you want, this is a test. This is sampling. And sampling in garment construction is absolutely critical. Weavers tend to start with vests as their first sewing project because they think, well, it's simple. There's only two pieces, the fronts and the backs. Sadly, the vest is the hardest area to fit. To get the neck and the armholes and the bust line shaping to fit properly in a close-fitting garment like that takes a lot of skill. And working on my own body, I've had to sometimes do as many as 6, 7, 8 muslins till I get it exactly the way I want it.
Even after your years and years of experience?
Yep.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
because each time I start something new, it's something new. It's a new pattern. And just because it exists in a pattern doesn't mean it's engineered properly. And this is up to you to take the body pieces and to start putting them together and to make it work for you. And there is no other way to do it but practice. But one of the great things about that is you begin to learn who you are now. And once you get past the mirror, one of the hardest things for me as a teacher, I can teach anybody to sew, and I can teach you the essentials of fit. What I can't teach you is to love what you see in the mirror. And if you don't love what you see in the mirror, nothing you make and put on yourself, you're going to love because you don't like what's there to begin with. And so one of my goals in teaching, when I get people through a class, is to have them stand in front of the mirror and burst into tears because they've just met themselves for the first time. And it's okay. And they can decorate themselves and they can celebrate themselves with something that came off their loom. And then I've done my job.
I know a lot of hand weavers are intimidated by sewing. Where would you suggest that a hand weaver who wants to take that next step, they've woven their 15th scarf and they just can't stand it anymore. They want to make something more tailored. Where do they go? What do they do?
If it were me personally, I would take that drawer of 15th scarves, open it up, find all the dish towels, start cutting up fabric and piece it together. I saw a vest once at a fashion show, and it was a convergence a few years ago. It totally blew me away. It was made up of a bunch of placemats. and I didn't know that until I actually read the description. I loved it because this person took the next step. It's cloth. It's all cloth. If you want to begin the clothing process, you must begin with a silhouette that works on your body. So don't even think about going to the loom and starting to make, well, actually you can, but that's a whole separate thread. Go make yardage. Just start playing with working bigger. Start playing with sets. Start playing with experimenting with different wefts. Get yourself some yardage. Start learning how to warp 5, 6, 8, 10 yards. That may be an issue for a number of people. I've had people write to me and say, well, I only have a 25-inch loom. Well, what do you think original yardage used to be? 18 inches wide. That was long before we had 60-inch mills. 18 inches is plenty for a quarter of the garment. If you have a center back seam, you have a left back and a right back and a left front and a right front, and 18 inches times 4 is pretty big around. Two of my looms are 25-inch. I do a lot of my yardage on 25-inch looms. There's nothing wrong with that. And by the time you've washed it and shrunk it down, you have a totally sufficient amount of stuff to work with. Begin by playing with yardage, but don't even think about cutting it until you get what it is that you're going to be making. Put the yardage away. It's a raw material now. And go back through your closet. Find all those pieces that you made back when styles were bigger and roomier. Did you make a throw? Well, that's a big hunk of fabric. How long has it been sitting on the back of your sofa? Okay, maybe it's time to move that from the sofa, give it a good washing, and put it on the shelf as a new raw material. Maybe there's a vest in there. Okay, maybe when you're finished, you don't have enough to do the whole vest, but you could certainly add side panels of something else. You could trim it in something else. I love the idea of making yardage and putting it aside, and then as a separate process altogether, start with a pattern. Stay within one of the commercial patterns that are well known and engineered, like a Vogue. And I know that they can be intimidating, but there's an engineering in Vogue that has always stayed true, and it's something to begin with. Doesn't have to be a complex shape. There's plenty of simplified shapes out there. Work on getting it to fit. That's a whole separate process than making this yardage that you just took off the loom into a garment. Separate the two. And in your mind, that's the first thing you need to do, is separate the two processes. Learn to make a pattern that works on you. Take one that already exists and alter and fit. There are tons of wonderful fit books out there, including the old Bible Vogue Sewing, which has just been reprinted in 2006, has a lot of fit information. Any of the Palmer Plesch series on fit, totally wonderful information. Get yourself a couple of fit books, try on that bed sheet that's been cut out of that pattern, and begin. And I will tell you also that I never destroy my original pattern. Most patterns come in multi-size. I keep the multi-sizes. I always trace it off onto something else and then work with that. Because if in all that I've gone so far with the thing that I have to start over again, which is totally possible, I have the original pattern to start with.
Right. And they're pretty spendy these days.
And they're very expensive. That's exactly correct. Start by separating the processes and begin to learn who you are physically. Begin to learn to fit your body. Get yourself a couple of good silhouettes that you're comfortable with, that you like. Then go look at the stash of yardage that you've begun to create. And maybe it's not a stash of yardage, but you're sewing together some scarves. Maybe you have 2 or 3 scarves that are off the same warp. Zigzag the 2 selvages together. You get a wider piece of cloth. Look, 2 9-inch scarves together give you 18 inches.
There you go.
That's right.
I'm getting to the point in my own weaving where I don't think I can weave another scarf.
Exactly. I do a class in pieced vests where you bring all that stuff, those scarves, those placemats, the scraps, the pieces that didn't work, and we cut them all up and make them into a very cool personal story vest.
What makes hand-woven fabric different than commercial fabric?
We don't have the facilities to really finish a fabric the way they do commercially. The yarns we use are usually much heavier, more interesting. One of the things I talk about with my students, when you first learn to weave, usually they teach you with a scarf. It's quick, it's easy, instant gratification. And you pick sets, that would be S-E-T-T, that would be appropriate to a scarf that would be soft and drapey around your neck. When you translate that into 45-inch wide fabric, 10 yards long, the set is not usually dense enough to support the garment construction details that you're going to put into it. The first lessons that I teach students when I'm working with them and teaching them how to weave for yardage is to work with the set. However dense you think it is, it probably needs to go denser. One of my students told me once, it's going to be written on my tombstone, should have been set denser.
So how do you tell when something is dense enough?
You really don't know. presumably each time you sit down and do something new, you're blazing new trails. Because if you're doing what you just did last week, well, you've already figured that out. What I recommend is when you put yardage on, and people say, well, how much should I weave? I said, whatever you have the yarn for. You know, this is yardage. And I will tell you this, which always shocks people when they hear it. I never have an end goal in mind. I weave to weave. When the yardage comes off, I process it for what it is, and then I put it on the shelf as a raw material. And then I separate from it. I may not come back to it for a couple of years. And when I do, I'm not so attached to it. It didn't just come off. It's a piece of yardage. And I get to then cut it up. Oh. Now, sometimes when I'm working, I'm envisioning as I'm weaving what this may become. But I don't really know until it's totally washed and finished. What's it going to feel like? What's it going to say to me? I can process something and end up with 4 yards when I started with 8. I don't even know what I'm going to end up with. So I don't have a goal in mind. And that leaves me much more flexible to separate the processes out into their own thing. That said, once I set the loom up, I make an educated guess based on structure and yarns and what I think the properties are going to do in the wash, and I begin to weave. And I sample all different kinds of wefts. And I pull things off the shelf, and I thought, well, let's try this. Well, what would I never think of using? Well, let's try that and see what happens. I try thick. I try thin. I try dark value, light value, mid value. I try wool. I try cotton. And so I may have 18 inches of sampling. Then I cut it off the loom. I divide that into 3 pieces. The first piece I put in my notebook because that's a good representation of what was on the loom to begin with. And then I can read more carefully what was the actual weft used because I can kind of see it. The second piece I process minimally. This is one of the other mistakes that a lot of hand weavers make. A person in one of my classes will come in with a gorgeous piece of yardage and they'll say to me, look, what do you think? And I'll start handling. Of course, that's the first thing we do when we see a textile. And I'll say, did you wash this? Oh, yes. And I said, okay, and how did you wash this? Well, I put it in the bathtub, and then I just did this gentle padding, and then, you know, like rolled it in a towel. And I said, yeah, it kind of feels like it. I said, okay, trot down to the laundromat. And then the color drains out of their face. So what I do with the second piece that I cut off of this sample is that I minimally process. I put it in the sink in the bathroom with a little bit of shampoo off my kid's bathroom because that's the closest to my studio. And I agitate it in warm water for maybe, you know, 5 minutes until I'm sick of agitating it and I get bored. And then I rinse it and roll it in a towel. And that's minimally processed. The third sample, I make sure I stitch well around the edges. And then I throw it in the next time I do a load of jeans and towels. So it goes through a full 14-minute wash with, you know, hard agitation, and then I throw it in the dryer till the towels are dry. So it is the worst case scenario. If you look at that totally processed and sometimes overprocessed piece of fabric that was through the washer and the dryer, and you can still move those warps and wefts around and it's still pretty sleazy, you didn't set it densely enough. I tend to combine structures in my fabric. I tend to put, say, twills next to plain weaves, and sometimes I'll combine different weights of yarn. So I will creatively slay the reed based on the structure that that particular section of warp is.
So you might slay the twills more densely in the plain weaves.
I always do. And sometimes I'll have this really fat yarn that kind of sits on a fine ground. So that may be totally slayed even differently. And sometimes I've got something that has to be put on the second beam. So I have all these different ways of approaching it, but you have to sample. You have to find out all the way through the washing process. Now, I may not throw everything that comes off the loom in the washer and dryer, but I've got a range now, and I know what I'm aiming for and what it's capable of. Even as densely as I weave and as well as it's finished, I rarely will make an actual tailored garment that is not completely backed with a fusible interfacing, because I want that handwoven fabric to totally behave itself.
That's for outerwear. If you were making something next to the skin,
then you have to pick and choose your construction details so that the fabric and the construction details will work as a team and not fight each other.
So by construction details, you mean seams?
The seam finishes, okay. The edge finishes, the details and where the seams are. The more complex the fabric and the more visually interesting, the simpler of a shape you want to make out of it. That's why I don't have any goal in mind, because I don't really know where I'm going with this fabric until it's done. And then I sit with it and separate myself from it. And then one day I may get the new Vogue in or the new Berta magazine, and they come in, I'm sitting down with my cup of tea and I'm going through it, and I see the silhouette. And there it is. And I know the piece of fabric that I want to do with it. And off I run.
What if you don't have enough fabric?
Oh, well, you go to plan B. And what I tell my students is we have a really great alphabet in our culture. It's 26 letters. I saw the greatest. I cut it out of the New Yorker, one of the New Yorker cartoons. And it had these two corporate guys. One is passing the next proposal over to the guy across the desk. And it says, Plan Z. And it was something to the effect of, man, if this one doesn't work, we're screwed. But there's an infinite number of plans. And what I tell my students is if you start out with a goal and you reach it with no effort, you didn't work very hard. You didn't push yourself. You didn't chart new territory. The further down the alphabet you go with plans, plan B, plan C, plan D, the more interesting the piece becomes because you've had to really think about it. You've had to draw. You've had to take a chance. And I have a stash of alternative fabrics and commercial stuff, and I'll grab some of this and I'll alter that and I'll cut on the crosswise grain and I will make it work because that's the most fun out of all this for me is to make it work. And there is infinite ways to do that. And you get to do that with clothing. I will tell you, I have never woven a dish towel. Seriously, 30 years of weaving, I have never woven a dish towel.
Why?
Absolutely no interest in weaving a dish towel. You weave it, you hem stitch it, okay, so then you do some handwork at the end, but it's a product off the loom. And there's no adventure. There's no banging your head against the wall going, okay, how do I bail out of this one? How do I make this work? How do I go to plan Z? And that's the part that I so adore. Which is why I love what I do now versus when I was in production where I was making the same thing over and over again. Each new piece is totally uncharted territory. Each new fabric I put on is a whole new adventure. And now that I've been playing around with hand-painted warps, that in itself is just a total new adventure. I've been mixing up dye pots, a little of this, a little of that. And then I run two and three different painted warps together. And I have no idea what I'm going to get at the end. And every time I advance the fabric, it's like, oh, wow, look at that color combination. I am totally in love with this spontaneous, serendipitous way of working. And then the cutting for the garment becomes really an issue because you've got this whole fabric laid out across the floor, 5 yards, 8 yards, and you walk around with the pattern pieces and find the best way to celebrate what's there on the floor. It's that adventure that keeps me fresh and coming back and constantly wanting to see what happens if. I've never tired of the combination of sewing and weaving.
I recently discovered that you have started selling monographs.
What a great addition this has been to my ability to reach out to the fiber community. Because a picture's worth 1,000 words.
Right, right.
So,
but it is very much a step-by-step of the process. It's as if you were in your workshop looking really close. Yes.
Right. But I've just added 2 new monographs, one on photographing your work, which being a photographer and having done my own photographs, and I've worked in the magazine and some of the images that we've gotten, you just want to hug the person and say, okay, let's go back to the beginning. This is not showing your work in its best light, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, it's a huge part of the process.
Absolutely.
Because if you do gorgeous work, but you can't photograph it well.
Photographing your work, and especially textiles, it's something that I've worked hard on. And then we have the color and inspiration one. So I've got a number of monographs off the lectures that are just, I hope, visually interesting to look at and have some great knowledge in them.
You brought a couple for me to sample, and you couldn't get them out of my clutches, so thank you for those.
You're welcome.
So if somebody wanted to investigate these, or perhaps even purchase them, are they available on your website?
Yes.
You're part of the Convergence Challenge. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
This has just been the most incredible fun. Actually, I can't tell you a whole lot about it, because it's all top secret. We've been sworn to not breathe a word of our designs.
We've cast the inside scoop.
I know, the inside scoop. But since it's been published that I'm part of it, and I will give the HGA a lot of credit for really trying to get a new generation of weavers. And an obvious place to draw from are the sewers. The people that are out there sewing, let them know what incredibly wonderful fabrics that they can weave. Just as a side story, I spent Thursday in New York City, because I live very close to it, at Mood Fabrics, which is a well-known fabric store, because that's where Project Runway, that's where they go and shop for their fabrics. And you know, I walked around there, and I'm so jaded, because the fabrics that come across my loom are so incredible. It was hard for me to look at commercial fabrics, even the ones that simulated hand wovens, and get excited about them at all, because I can do just incredible things on my loom.
Commercial fabrics these days seems kind of lifeless.
Yeah, lifeless. That's a perfect description, lifeless, because my hand didn't touch it. The Convergence Challenge, what I think that the goal was to link the weaving world with the sewing world. So by taking a sewing personality and linking it to a weaver, they were creating a team. And then they gave us the yarn, which is the Convergence yarns, which, you know, if you go on the Convergence website, you'll see them. They're dyed in these Floridian colors. And you could just picture dancing flamingos on the water. I think that's the logo, too. So we were sent the yarn. And the challenge is that you have to work as a collaborative team, weaver and sewer, and using each of the yarns in the piece. And we have to create an ensemble for the runway. This is such an incredible challenge from so many ways. Using someone else's choice of color and yarn, working with another person who you've never met and has a totally different way of working. I have been assigned to work with a very creative fiber craftsman named Loretta Phipps from Texas. Well, there's a big difference just in style from Texas and New Jersey, which is basically a bedroom of New York where I live. So you're talking New York versus Texas. Right away, we have a total different style. And of course, there's the give and take of not wanting to be the one totally in control here, but being sensitive to your partner and making sure that we work together. We have to keep a journal, absolutely document every word that we say to each other, you know, which email's great because you just print it out and there it is. This is going to be a piece that we're going to together experience and build and see where it takes us.
I want to talk now about some of your artwork that when I saw it, it just blew me away.
My art pieces.
Can you describe, for example, past lives and what went into it?
My husband and I were told that we couldn't have kids, or they didn't think that we could have kids, and that was not a big deal. Well, in my mid-30s, I found myself pregnant. That totally threw both of us because it wasn't something that we had planned for or expected to happen in our lives. Before that, I was a craftsman. We traveled a lot. When I had kids, my production years and my income stopped. So my life as a craftsman totally changed. And I will tell you, those were some dark years because I had a child, and you adapt and you adjust, but it totally threw my direction creatively. The income stopped. It was very hard for me to weave with a toddler around. Of course, and I didn't have that cute little baby that sat in the basket and gurgled. But there's something incredibly wonderful about a kid that you have to peel from the ceiling on a regular basis, but it really curbs your creativity. I found, though, that having been a production hand weaver for 10 years, I saved every scrap of fabric from those 30-yard runs. And when you cut out garments, they're scrap. In my attic, carefully cataloged in banker's boxes. My great-grandchildren will not make a dent in the scraps in my attic. So I found I could still be creative with the sewing machine, who's never let me down, and those scraps. And I could begin to piece together garments from things that were basically scrap. And I could make something that didn't exist before without actually having to set up the loom. It was still hand woven, but I was giving it a new life. And even some of my old production work that didn't sell, I could cut it up again. The Past Lives piece showed photographs. I had always wanted a way to link my fiber and my love of photography, to be able to put the two mediums together. And there are a lot of ways to transfer images to cloth. In the quilt world, the ability to put images onto fabric is effortless. You just buy a sheet, stick it in your inkjet printer, and it just prints right on the cloth, and it's totally stable. My husband and I traveled to England a lot. And I would, of course, take cameras, and we shot in black and white. And we ended up having these boxes of images. And I would look at them now being at home with a child and, you know, think that that was another part of my life. The Past Lives piece, there were a number of things going on there. First, that was an old production coat that never sold that I found in the attic that I cut up. So I gave it a new life. it's totally lined with a Persian lamb coat. Now, I remember having it in an exhibit and having somebody totally stressed with me because I used animal fur. Well, I looked at it that I gave this animal, which I didn't kill, which was left from a time and fashion when we thought this was a cool thing to do. And it was dry rotted and I was able to salvage the pieces that weren't and piece it carefully back together and line this vest with it. And I gave that piece of fur another life. The images on it were images from another life. And the only thing that I did on it that I actually created new was the 12 yards of inkle-woven band that I used to border off all the piecing from the hand-woven coat. It was a way of incorporating all those pieces of my life. I went on to do a piece that's called In Memoriam. I worked on that intently for a number of months. There were a lot of things, pivotal things happening in my life at that point. I was getting to an age where friends were hitting, and myself really, that midpoint crisis point in your life. Is this what there is? You know, a lot of us were young mom. Well, I wasn't a young mom, but a lot of my peers were, you know, and we were stuck. You know, we had kids that were the focus of our lives, and our lives as we knew it either came to a screeching halt or became so difficult to continue that it just wasn't worth it. And I saw some old friends that I'd lost touch with come back into my lives, and you'd greet them and you'd say, how you doing? Well, I lost a breast. I lost a husband. In a female life, there are these stages. I had a friend who was turning 40, and the first thing she wanted was a facelift. And that was such a foreign thing to me because I'm not so attached to my body. It isn't about what my body looks like. It's how it performs for me as a craftsman. And I will tell you, having worked for women for 40 years, sewing for them, working with the fight that they have in the mirror and the sadness with which they look at their bodies with, not with pride, but with, you know, I hate to say it, sometimes self-loathing. You know, it's so sad to see them so disconnected to who they are physically. Our society places such an importance to how you physically look, how thin you are. I mean, it's a horrible thing to do. I remember when my daughter was at a birthday party at a salon. That was the like big thing to do when my daughter was young, is they'd all meet at a salon. They'd get their hair and nails done. And I kept thinking, oh my God, what are we teaching them? At the end of this little escapade where they all stood in front of the mirror, I actually watched this one little girl. Her name was Frankie. And she danced in front of the mirror and she pirouetted and she showed off the sparkles in her hair and her purple fingernails with the sparkles. And I looked at that child and I began to cry inside because I knew that that was probably the last time Frankie would look in that mirror and ever absolutely love everything about herself. And I really began to understand and look at differently what it means to pay attention. And then, of course, going through cancer and losing, beginning to lose parts of your body, you realize that there was an end to it. And if you don't celebrate what you have, whatever it looks like, now, you know, how sad, how incredibly sad. So when I did the piece In Memoriam, we place so much importance on that physical body. And when it isn't what it used to be in its 20s, when you've peaked and it begins to all change and diminish and not be as tight and firm and thin as it once was, we separate from it. And that piece was really about women who put too much emphasis on what they physically are and who they physically are and don't have anything else to connect to. And in that piece, Deanne, who was this fictional character, represented a lot of the women who had crossed paths in my life, women who were now stuck at home with children. And I don't mean to say stuck at home, because that is an incredibly important part of our society. But women who give up who they are or never totally find their potential because their lives are lived through their children. How sad that is. A lot of women come to hand weaving after the kids are grown and they're retired from their jobs and they find this new life. And that's why I love to teach them how to then make something for themselves that goes on themselves, that they get total compliments and touchy-feely, and it's about wrapping yourself in something from your hands. But this piece meant a lot to me because inside in the lining, what I loved about the piece was it had digital images on the outside. It had this image of this, a nude that I appropriated from a Vargas girl and then did a lot of Photoshop to make it work and blew it up to almost life size on the back. And then inside, if you open it, there's this lining, which in clothing is a great metaphor because there's this secret thing that only you see. You know, the lining is what's inside. And in this case, you open it up and there's this sort of high school locker kind of pictures all stuck all over it, pictures from yearbooks, pictures. And these are all pictures, if you look at the individual pictures, of people that actually meant something, that crossed my path, friends of mine in high school who ended up dying of AIDS. There are all these secret kind of messages that mean something to me. But there was a picture of me in kindergarten, my entire kindergarten class. And that was really as a symbol to my daughter. Because at the time, she was just graduating kindergarten. She had her whole life ahead of her. What kinds of messages can I give her to not be so caught up in what society dictates is important as a female to look like and be like?
Coming up next, we have an audio essay, Uniquely Me, which describes your humble host's first tentative steps towards learning how to sew with her handwoven fabric. And I must say, it's only been possible with a little help from my friends. Before we head off to that, I'm going to play you a song. Now, when I went up to the PodSafe Music Network looking for fabric and sewing themed music, you would be surprised how little there was. So this song is called More Than You Seem by Causeway. Yes, I know. It's a stretch. Seem, you get it? Okay, well, I tried.
Last night was a lot to remember, taking a turn in my world. Good morning, darling, I still smell you on my sweatshirt. Last night was hard and he didn't love me, yeah, spin me around. Well, I felt so deep. Was sipping something sweet. And now I am remembering you are more than you seem. Mix up a match so you've got two in a row. I've got a mouthful of inside jokes, and you laugh like you know. Well, I felt so deep. Was sipping something sweet. And now I am remembering you are more than you. Same, yeah.
A bartender, can I get a whiskey? A bartender, can I get a gin? A bartender, can I get a sea breeze for the girl that just walked in? Please tell her it's from me.
I felt so deep. Was sipping something sweet. And now I am remembering you are more than you say.
Bartender,
you are more than you say.
The bartender, can I get a whiskey? Bartender,
you are more than you say.
Every decade or so, I promise myself that I'm going to finally learn how to sew. I have this dream of creating art garments that are unique and special and cool and perfectly fitted to flatter my body. And every decade or so, I make a few things that kind of fit like a potato sack, and I jab myself with pins. I think the last time I sat down and sewed seriously was my wedding, which was about a decade ago, so I'm due. And of course, during the process of editing Daryl Lancaster's interview, I got very excited about sewing. And so late one night, I ordered a Uniquely You dress form. Because the one thing that really keeps me from being successful with this is the inability to fit. I have never found myself in a situation where I had a fitting buddy who lived next door. And attempts to get Eric to learn how to fit me have generally ended with screaming and crying and somebody being poked with pins, usually me. So the dress form came a couple of days later, and I took it out of the box, and here was this enormous foam woman with torpedo breasts. I kid you not, it was astounding. And I put it in my studio, and I was like, oh dear, the very thing that made me want the dress form will make it impossible for me to custom fit the cover so that the dress form will represent me. And I kind of panicked, because there's nothing like having a giant foam woman in your studio screaming, bad purchase. How was I going to do this? I was racking my brain. Who could help me with this? And I recalled that one of my friends actually is a professional tailor. Yay! So I sent this impassioned email, please, please help a sewing newbie fit her dress form so that she may go off and teach herself to sew. And my friend Selah, who had an article in the first Weave Zine, that cool network cable scarf, said, no worries. Come on over. We'll get this thing fitted. And I showed up and I brought the bra that I was planning to wear for my art garments and the proper shoes. I decided after some contemplation that if I went to the trouble to make something from my hand-woven cloth, it would probably be a fancy something. So I brought the push-up bra and the high heels and showed up with my big foam woman under my arm and my muslin cover in the other hand. And I spent the evening in a bathrobe, push-up bra, and high heels. And it was an entertaining evening. I really wished I could have done more of the work, but because you can't really fit yourself, and because I'm really kind of clueless about sewing, I ended up just having to let Selah help me, which was a wonderful gift of her time, and I'm very grateful for. We spent the evening chatting. Occasionally, I would take off a bathrobe and put on a muslin cover, and she would do magical things with pens and markers and then go off to the sewing machine. We watched a little bit of Torchwood, and it was a wonderful time. It was also a long time. I should warn you, if you're thinking about going the Uniquely You dress form route, that my friend Selah, experienced seamstress, was not working as fast as she could, but she was not dawdling either. She was working at a good, steady workhorse pace, and it took 4.5 hours. No lie. Block out an evening, an afternoon, if you want to undertake this. We worked on the muslin cover until it fit me like a second skin, until I was like one of those Chinese ladies in the incredibly fitted silk dresses and had to walk like Morticia Adams. And then it was time to put it on the dress form. And we had to squish and zip and squish and zip. But when we were done, it was really enlightening. The motto of Uniquely You is see yourself as others see you. And I have to confess that tagline really scared me, because I didn't want to see myself as others saw me with all my lumps and bumps. But when we got that dress form wrestled into that cover that was perfectly fitted to my body, I stood back and I looked at it, and I was really surprised at my reaction. I had had this vision of what I looked like in my head based on what I see when I look in the mirror. I had never seen a three-dimensional representation of myself. And the thought that crossed through my head when I looked at the fitted form was, hey, not bad. was in that moment that I realized that my body image was way off from what I actually was. And even if I don't learn to sew this decade, I have to tell you, that moment of finally understanding what my husband meant when he puts his arms around me and goes, "Honey, you look good to me." What that's all about. I'm not swimsuit model material. I'm not super skinny. I've got lots of curves. But you know, they're not bad. That's all for this episode. So until next episode, it's time to get warped. Because everyone knows you've got to be warped to weave. Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Gina, Kathleen, and Deborah. Thank you so much for helping to support the show. Our sponsor this episode is Robin Spady of Spady Studios, who offers wonderful programs, workshops, and private instruction. For more information, go to her website, www.spadystudios.com. Additional funding for Weavecast is provided by the Seattle Weavers Guild and the Hand Weavers Guild of America. Our musical guest this episode was Causeway with their song, "More Than You Seem," which was distributed by the PodSafe Music Network.